Hello, hello. Can you hear that? Is that working? Yeah. Okay. My name is Susan Phillips. I'm the senior climate reporter and editor with WHYY, which is the member station here in Philadelphia. You may wonder, like, why is a local reporter moderating this panel? Only because I pitched it. and so here I am. But I think we've got a great program today, and I'm very excited. It's a topic I'm very interested in. And it's one of those things where, of course, you know, when we think of war coverage, obviously it makes sense that the primary issues are the humanitarian issues, right? People are dying, people are, you know, losing friends and family, people have to leave their homes. There's so many issues that we know about, especially from the most recent wars in Gaza and Ukraine, and lots of coverage about that. We're also going to hear from Alan about the potentials and the dangers of nuclear winter and potential nuclear war. But I think the reason why I'm interested in this is because it is an important, and I think you'll hear from the panelists not just the immediate environmental impacts, but also we have someone here who's, you know, documented environmental impacts that, you know, 50, 60 years after the bombing in Laos. So I just want to do some brief intros to our panelists. Everything, I mean, SEJ, just so you guys know, like, they want everything to be brief. They like it to be interactive. So we want interaction from the audience. We want your questions. And we do prioritize questions from journalists first. So they wanted me to let you all know that. We don't like speechifying, so questions, answers, and I'm sure journalists know that. So just putting that out there. So to my right, I'll just first introduce the folks here in the room. And I have my little cheat sheet here. Hold on. Carolyn Beeler. I actually used to work with Carolyn at WHYY, but she is now the co-host of The World, where she has spent 8 years traveling the globe, covering the environment. I'm sure a lot of you have heard her amazing stories on the air. And she was recently, last summer, went to report on the environmental impacts of the war in Ukraine. Okay, I'm going to skip down here. To her right is Karen Coates. Karen is an investigative reporter and fellowship editor at Manga Bay. And she has a new documentary out, and we're going to see a little screening of that, called Eternal Harvest, which traces the environmental legacy of the U.S. bombing campaign in Laos from 1964 to 1973. And then we have our illustrious guests tuning in from North Jersey and East Jerusalem. So Dr. Alan Robach, he's a climatologist at Rutgers University, and he's here to talk to us about the current and continuing threat of nuclear winter. And then Tarek Abu Hamed runs the Arava Institute for Environmental Studies, which, among other things, engages in environmental diplomacy and believes that nature knows no boundaries. I met Tarek while I was in Israel over a year ago reporting, and I was trying to do a story with him. It didn't work out. But he's a great guy. And again, he's joining us from East Jerusalem, and he's going to talk to us about the impact of the current conflict in Gaza and the region in general. So let's start with Carolyn. And everyone's, all the folks have, have put together like a 5-minute presentation, and then I might ask them a few questions, and then we're going to take questions from the audience, because I'm sure you guys have lots of questions about this.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks for coming to listen to us chat. I will keep this very brief because I know you all have questions that are going to be better than what I can say. Actually, can I have my notes, though? I forgot those.
With these?
Yeah. My name is Carolyn. As Susan mentioned, I was an environment correspondent and an editor at The World for about 8 years. The World is a public radio show. I don't just say I co-host the entire world. That would be quite the title. But I was the environment correspondent before that. So I'm going to talk to you about my reporting in Ukraine. Last summer, I was reporting on the environmental impact of the war there. So my boss came to me about this time last year and said, hey, do you want to report on the environmental impact of the war in Ukraine? And I thought, I don't know if it's the right time for that. People are still dying. And then I looked into it a little bit more and thought about how what was happening there was going to continue to impact people's lives in very real ways for decades to come. And so, you know, ended up going and doing this reporting. So a couple of headlines of what I found, and then I'll tell you a little bit about kind of the behind the scenes on reporting there. So there's old school trench warfare happening along about a 600-mile front in Ukraine. So that is tearing up ecosystems, forests, soil systems all along that front line. Artillery shells and bombings are starting forest fires. About half of the forest fires that happened in the first year of the war were within 40 miles of that front line. About a third of the land Ukraine estimates in Ukraine, including a lot of farmland, is now covered in unexploded ordnance and mines, which you're going to hear a lot more from, I think, from one of the other panelists. And that has to be cleaned in order to be usable. In a country where agriculture is a major part of the economy, tens of thousands of gallons of oil have spilled into the soil and leached into probably groundwater also because Russian strikes have been targeting oil depots, especially in the early days of the war. Drinking water has been cut off and sewage systems have been destroyed by bombings. The excess greenhouse gas emissions in just the first year of the war were thought to be about the same size as the annual emissions of Belgium. So there's your climate impact. In all, the Ukrainian government estimates about $61 billion of damage has been done to the environment. That's an up-to-date figure. Some of the other figures were, you know, a little bit earlier from about earlier in the war. So like I said, a lot of this is going to take decades to remediate, and some of it will never return to normal. We're talking about ecosystems that are being torn up. So, you know, ecosystems can sometimes never return to their pre-impact state. So a little about the reporting. I had been to Ukraine several months prior to this, so I knew some of the basics of reporting in a country at war. So I knew how to get into and out of the country when the airspace was closed. Short stories, very long train rides. You know, I had my body armor, I had security plans in place. So the reporting ahead of my reporting trip was similar to any other reporting project. Who are the experts? Who has the data? Is there any science published on this that's peer-reviewed that you can cite? On one level, it was interesting because the Ukrainian government is making a very concerted effort to document the environmental impact of the war, but they're doing that in order to eventually, they hope, hold Russia accountable with, you know, hoping to win money from them at some point in some sort of international court. So what they're doing is making these estimates of the dollar figure of environmental damage. So they have this big aggregated, you know, $1 billion figure, and they're not documenting in an accessible way so much what that actually means in terms of water resources, in terms of land. So it's a little hard to tease out what they're measuring there. So you do have the government tracking that. The local government and regional government pretty much has bigger fish to fry right now. They're not doing a ton of remediation work on environmental damage, and this isn't a super high priority because they're trying to protect their populations. So there's not a lot of granular data on the ground. So, you know, I got the big picture data that I could, and then I went out and reported and talked to people about what these impacts look like. So I talked to a farmer at the edge of his farm field that was overgrown because it was littered with mines. No one had been able to step into that farm field for a year. And he talked about how the Ukrainian forces in the early days of the war were over here, the Russians were over here, and his farm fields were the no man's land that got littered with ordnance. So that's going to take a very long time to clean up, and that's all over large swaths of the country. I visited a village that was downhill from this massive oil depot that was blown up, and still this pond that people used to swim and fish in and go to for recreation, there was still oil about a year and a half after this explosion happened, bubbling up from the bottom into this pond. So that was an impact on locals. I went to this national forest where a missile had been shot down. It didn't even explode, but it left this big impact crater in this forest, and I could see the trees had turned into charcoal, and I could smell this acrid smell of jet fuel. So, you know, you take your listeners, in my case, to those places to show those impacts. And just one more point here, some of the unique challenges of reporting in an active conflict area. I can answer questions about this later if you're interested in the logistics, but one of the main challenges, of course, is security. So there's air raid sirens going off all the time. You have to figure out what to do about that. If you want to go to the bunker every time or take some local guidance on when you actually need to take cover. My news organization does not send people to active combat zones. So we were not right on the front line. We were in Kyiv, in the environs, up kind of close to the Belarusian-Russian border. But so I was reporting on impacts that had happened several months in the past. The Kakhovka Dam was blown up and burst while I was there. That's probably the biggest environmental impact of this war. And I wasn't allowed to go there because it was literally the front lines of the war. So that was hard. I lobbied my boss and said, can I please go cover that? And he said, no, thank you. So the security challenges are part of that. So those are my comments for now. And I'll turn it over to whoever's next.
Karen. So before I say anything, I wanted to actually just show about 2 minutes of video, the trailer to the film that my husband and I produced called Eternal Harvest. And you will see in the video why we gave that title.
Okay.
There's a share screen button at the bottom.
Oh, okay. Hold on.
And all we want in Laos is peace, not war. And all we want in Laos is peace, not war.
There are no American combat forces in Laos.
We do have American combat forces in Laos.
1963. The United States dropped more than 2 million tons of bombs 1973. Here in Laos. The United States dropped more than 2 million tons of bombs here in Laos. It was a secret war.
And all we want in Laos is peace, not war.
There are no American combat forces in Laos. We do have perhaps some other activities.
1964 to 1973, the United States dropped more than 2 million tons of bombs here in Laos. It was a secret war.
It is a solvable problem. It is a resource problem.
We're giving for a whole year of cleanup what we used to spend on days, just days of bombing.
In the future, United States can consider funding, more funding. Now, not enough funding.
You know, you can know about it, but you don't really know about it until you see it.
as you can see from that, a war that took place more than 50 years ago is still dramatically affecting both people and the environment. And people are part of the environment. And I want to thank SEJ and Susan and my co-panelists for doing this session, because I've spent a lot of time over the years trying to convince editors that war is an environmental issue. And it absolutely is, especially in a country like Laos, where 75% of the population is farming. And yet, it's dangerous. It's dangerous to dig. It's dangerous to go out into the forest and collect herbs or try to look for food. It's dangerous to fish, because there are more than probably 80 million live bombs in the ground. And the main problem are these cluster munitions, which are about the size of a baseball. They were scattered everywhere. And so a war like that affects how people react with their environment. It means people are afraid. It means they can't do the things they need to do to survive. And clearance itself is incredibly destructive, because you have to clear the land of brush and trees before you can even begin to look for the bombs in the ground. So that alone is destruction. And there's also a term that's fairly new. It's called bomb turbation, which is the phenomenon of a massive bombing and what it does to the soil. It turbates the soil. It mixes the layers, the sediments, and the landscape is changed. So if you fly over Laos, you can still see craters everywhere, pockmarked across the landscape. In many of those places, the native vegetation no longer grows. It's different. It's not always bad. In some cases, farmers use those craters to have ponds. Animals use them. But it's changed. And so warfare is absolutely an environmental issue. And I'm happy to answer all sorts of questions from you about how we went about this and so on.
Thank you. That's great. Thanks, Karen. And yeah, we're going to get to questions after everyone does their presentation. So now, let's see, next up is Alan.
Okay. I want to share my screen. Can you see that?
Yes, we can.
Okay, so hi, I'm a climate scientist. I want to talk about the worst thing that could happen environmentally because of war, and that's nuclear winter. Here's our beautiful planet, but after a nuclear war, it might look like this, with clouds of smoke covering the planet, blocking out the sun and making it cold and dark at the Earth's surface. And if there's enough smoke, it would be nuclear winter. Temperatures would be below freezing even in the summertime. And obviously this would have an effect on the ecosystem and also on agriculture. This was discovered 40 years ago when scientists pointed out there'd be smoke after nuclear war. And there were papers written by both Russian and American scientists, including me, pointing out that there would be nuclear winter. This was a huge influence on and then the nuclear arms race ended. But it was, the Soviet Union ended 5 years later. This is a graph of the total number of weapons, mostly Russian and U.S. And the problem is there's still more than 10,000 nuclear weapons on Earth. So Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev, who ended the arms race, gave credit to the scientists. A great many scientists are telling such a war could end up in no victory for anyone. And Gorbachev said, models made by Russian and American scientists showed that a nuclear war would result in a nuclear winter. So there's 12,500 nuclear weapons now, and there's the U.S. and Russia have more than 90% of them, but there's seven other countries, including India and Pakistan. And we decided to look at what would happen if India and Pakistan had a nuclear war because of a battle in Kashmir. And we calculated with our climate model where the smoke would go from the fires that would burn by the bombs, and the smoke would go up into the upper atmosphere. This line is the troposphere, where tropopause, we live down here where rain washes smoke out, but if it's heated by the sun, it goes up into the stratosphere, it can last for years and blow around the world and cause climate change. And if that happened, 20 years ago, it could produce 5 million tons of smoke and produce instant climate change. This is the global warming that is a problem that, of course, we're all addressing, but it would be instant climate change and colder than the Little Ice Age. Now, we have a modern climate model that we've used, and it turns out that Pakistan and India are having their own mini arms race, and they have more nuclear weapons. And now we think that 16 to 37 teragrams, or millions of tons of smoke, could be produced by war between India and Pakistan. And so we looked at different scenarios of different amounts of bombs, the size of the bombs, and how much smoke it would produce. And a U.S.-Russia war could produce 150 million tons of smoke. And so the important thing is how it would affect agriculture. So we wrote a paper a couple years ago looking at different scenarios, including on crops and fisheries and livestock. And the temperatures would get 15 degrees below normal Celsius. That when there's a little ice age, it's only 5 degrees colder than normal. But for 5 years, there would be huge cooling and a huge reduction of calories available for people to eat after they used the food that was stored. And so if there was an India-Pakistan war, this is a map showing the percent of people that starved to death at the end of the second year. And in the red, more than half the people would starve. A U.S.-Russia war, almost everybody would starve to death because there would be no agriculture. A few places, Argentina, Australia, would be better off because they are big exporters and they don't have a big population. So we calculated the horrific direct number of people that would die from a nuclear war. 50 million people died in World War II. An India-Pakistan war could produce this many direct fatalities, and a U.S.-Russia war this many. But the number of people that would starve to death is more than 10 times that. So a war between India and Pakistan could kill 1 to 2 billion people, and a U.S.-Russia war could kill most of the Earth's population. The International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons had conferences on the humanitarian impacts of nuclear war and then got a treaty passed in the United Nations in 2017. And they got the Nobel Peace Prize that year for its work to draw attention to the catastrophic humanitarian consequence and for its efforts to produce a treaty. Beatrice Finn, the director, said, "The story of nuclear weapons will have an end, and it's up to us what that ending will be. Will it be the end of nuclear weapons, or will it be the end of us? One of these things will happen. The only rational course of action is to cease living under the conditions where mutual destruction is one impulsive tantrum away." And so I hope we can learn from this and keep our planet looking like this for a long time to come. If you want more information, I have it all on my website. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Alan. And next we have Tarek.
You're muted, Tarek.
Oh, sorry.
Okay, hi everyone. My name is Tarek Abu Hamid. I'm the executive director of the Arava Institute for Environmental Studies. I don't know why this is.
Yeah, we can see it.
Yeah, but it's, yes, okay. The Arava Institute is located southern Israel in the tip of the southern part of the Negev Desert in the Arava Valley. It's very close to the Red Sea, probably 30 miles from the Red Sea. And our mission is to advance cross-border environmental cooperation in the face of the political conflict. And why do we do that? Because the Middle East and the Eastern Mediterranean is considered as a hotspot when it comes to climate change. The region is warming 20% faster than the global average. The increase in the air temperature here is much higher than the global average. The acidity of the Eastern Mediterranean is increasing compared in very high rates compared to the rest of the oceans around the world. And as all of us know, climate change is an issue that cannot be dealt by one country. Global cooperation, and especially regional cooperation, is a must. And Here in the Middle East, we share, and I will show that in my slides, we share most of the natural resources. So it's not enough if one country alone cleans its rivers, deal with the aquifer, try to help people adapt or cope with the climate change. But what is lacking in the Middle East? Here, we have plenty of peace treaties. Israel has treaties with its neighbors, with the Palestinians, with the Egyptians, with the Jordanians, and lately with the Abraham Accords with the Gulf countries and Morocco. But is there real peace? No, this peace is only on paper and it's not between people. Does this region that we live in lack natural resources? No, it does not. We have plenty of sun. The Negev, the southern parts of Israel, the southern parts of the West Bank, Jordan, we receive one of the highest solar radiations in the world. We receive 1150 watts per square meter in this part of the world and in the world. And we also have the right technologies that we can use to produce our water. We have the solar energy that we can produce our electricity, that we can desalinate water, generate water not only for people, but also for agriculture to produce our food. So we have the right natural resources and we have the right technologies. But what is lacking in the Middle East is trust. People do not trust each other. And that prevents us here, the countries in this region, from working in a cooperative way to deal with the impact of the climate change. So conflict, wars are preventing us from dealing with the environmental challenges that we have in this region. And this is what we try to do at the Arava Institute. We do this by two main activities. One is the academic program. One third of our students are Arabic speakers, Palestinians, Israeli Arabs, Jordanians, Moroccans, Sudanese, students from North Africa. Students come together, study this environmental program. They live with each other 24/7 for a full academic semester. They go to the same dining room, to the same classroom, and they share rooms on the campus. And we use this environmental academic program as a diplomacy tool, as a bridge to connect between people. We use environment to help people see the human in the other, to have that human interaction. And this is how they can build understanding and build a trust. And they generate a community of environmental leaders that they deal with the environmental challenges of the region. And we do that also through our research programs. We have several research programs at the Arava Institute on renewable energy, water management, sustainable agriculture, social ecological research, and also the Regional Climate Change Policy Center. Most of the research that we implement here at the Arava Institute has the transboundary aspect. That means we deal with scientific research and also projects on the ground that are done or implemented by Palestinians, Jordanians, and Israelis together, because we share most of the natural resources in the region. All major water resources in the Middle East has the transboundary aspect. That means that are shared between the countries. Here you can see a map of Israel, Palestine, and Jordan. And 60% of the fresh water that we receive here in this region has the transboundary aspect. That means rivers originate in Israel, go to the West Bank, go to Jordan. So we share the surface water, and also we share the aquifer. Each color, this is also Jordan-Israel map together. Each color here in this map represents an aquifer. And as you can see here from this map, all the aquifers are shared between Israel-Palestine, Israel-Jordan, Palestine-Jordan, Jordan Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Iraq. That means all of our aquifer, all of our underwater is shared between the countries. So if an environmental disaster happens because of a war, because of a conflict, it impacts everyone in the region. And in order to deal with these environmental challenges, in order to clean the aquifer or prevent the pollution of the aquifer, you have to work with your neighbors. But we do not have peace because of the conflict. We do not have trust. We do not have the right partners on the other side, in Palestine, in Jordan, in Israel. And that's what we do at the Arava Institute. We use the environment to bring people together, build the trust, and deal with the environmental challenges that we have. And we have plenty of projects in the region, in Jordan, in Morocco, in the West Bank, and even in Gaza before October 7th, before the war. Gaza and the impact of the war in the environment. This war happened on October 7th. Before October 7th, 70% of the beaches, 75% of the beaches in Gaza were polluted with sewage. 97% of the aquifer is polluted. People used to receive 48 hours of electricity. And 70% of the population in Gaza under the age of 30. That means we have almost 1.5 million people in Gaza below the age of 30. And after October 7th, with the bombardments of Israel, the situation became worse. All infrastructure is destroyed now in Gaza. Lack of electricity, zero wastewater treatment. Air pollution is very high, and the estimation that the air pollution is equivalent, this is the daily air pollution, is equivalent to burning 2,500 tons of carbon. This is the aerial bombardments. These are the tanks, the movement of the army vehicles. We're talking about the Gaza Strip, which the vast majority of people are refugees and they live in refugee camps. That means these people are still using asbestos, and this asbestos was destroyed by the bombardments. So the air pollution, particulate matter, includes also a significant amount of asbestos. The infiltration of the wastewater, untreated wastewater, into the aquifer increased. Not only into the aquifer, but also into the eastern Mediterranean. And we know that the streams in the eastern Mediterranean are south to north. That means the pollution doesn't stay in Gaza. The coastal aquifer is shared between Gaza and Israel. That means also the aquifer in Israel is polluted. The eastern Mediterranean is polluted because of the sewage that comes from Gaza because of this war. Public health issues, the agriculture, the agricultural diseases, they will soon cross to Israel, and Israel will also suffer from the impact of this war in not only in the environment in Gaza, but also on the Israeli side. I will stop here, and I'll be more than happy to answer any questions if you may have. And this is my email. Yeah, I think I did not show my first slide. Thank you all.
Thank you. That's great. Can everyone hear me? Yeah. Okay. I mean, I think we're running a little late, so I have some questions, but I just wanted to throw it out to the audience first. If anyone's got questions, yes.
I'm Devin Farmelo. I am a graduate student at CU Boulder, getting my master's in journalism. And I'm interested in hearing about the use of the environment as kind of a tactic in war, like poisoning agricultural enterprises, and just like you mentioned, the dam in the Ukraine, and kind of just your guys' thoughts on that as a tactic, and also just like the overarching implications for the environment and the people who live in those areas.
So was that one specific panelist or just all the panelists? Okay. Anyone, any volunteers? Or let's look with, you're on the screen, Tarek, so why don't you answer that first, and we'll see if anyone else in the panel wants to jump in. Did you hear the question, by the way?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's the impact on agriculture, right?
Sort of like war, environmental impact as a weapon, really, right? Is that what you're asking? Poisoning agricultural, poisoning water. I don't know if that's actually happened. But yeah, if that's something that you can tackle.
No, actually, it's the impact is an indirect impact. It's not that they poisoned agriculture by purpose. It's never used in this region. But the indirect impact is very clear. The Gaza, okay, it's a very dense area. But it's a region that relies a lot on agriculture, and there are a lot of agricultural activities in Gaza, greenhouses, production of mainly, vegetables, and some kind of special trees that grow in Gaza. And the Gazans were not able, to treat these trees or this agriculture. So agricultural, diseases will for sure they are now in Gaza, and they will pass into Israel, other countries in the region. But we here at the Arava Institute do the opposite. We use environment to build peace because it's a common interest. It's the water, public health, air pollution. This impacts everyone in the region. So there is a common interest that we use here as a diplomacy tool to bring people together, scientists, engineers, technicians, farmers, community leaders. And we use environment. We solve environmental issues by providing people with clean drinking water or better agricultural techniques, and use these techniques to, you know, give people the opportunity to see the human in the other. And when that's happened, you generate a community of people who are willing to cooperate with each other and solve the region's environmental problems.
Thank you.
Alan, did you want to jump in?
Yeah, I'd like to answer the question on a different scale. If there was a nuclear war, the smoke from the fires would go up and cover the whole world and have environmental impacts globally, far removed from where the bombs were dropped. There are 70 countries have ratified the treaty to ban nuclear weapons. They're telling the 9 nuclear nations, we don't want you to have them because of the impacts it will have on us, even if no bombs are dropped here. And the nuclear nations say, oh, we don't want to use them for war. We want to use them for deterrence, which means you're threatening to use them. But if the U.S. used our nuclear arsenal against Russia, everybody in the U.S. would die from starvation because of the environmental impact. So threatening to use them is acting like a suicide bomber. It makes no sense at all.
Interesting.
Yes. It's interesting because just on that, like, I don't know, there's a lot of young people in the audience, but I remember, I'm old enough to remember mutually assured destruction, right? And my social studies teacher in seventh grade kind of explained this to us. It was the first time I had heard about nuclear war, really. And it was like so shocking, right?
It's actually self-assured destruction.
It's what?
It's self-assured destruction. If we use them, we'll kill ourselves. So it makes no sense.
Right. And I'm just wondering, Carolyn or Karen, do you, either one of you, have anything to add to this idea that, you know, it's a deliberate act of war?
I think is this on? Yeah. Okay. I think what I saw in Ukraine was mostly it's incidental, but you know, nature has always been used as part of warfare, and you know, going back forever, like the practice of salting the earth was so that crops couldn't grow there anymore. You would starve your opponents in war. In Ukraine, like the dams have been used by both the Russians and Ukrainians. Specifically to create environmental barriers to combat. So the Kakhovka Dam was probably a strategic move. And then the Ukrainians blew up a dam on the Irpin River, so it flooded some areas so the Russians couldn't advance at a certain point in the battle for Kyiv, basically. So nature was being used as a tool of war. So that's like a slightly different answer to your question. But there are, you can maybe talk to more about this, but there are types of cluster munitions. There are munitions designed and mines designed to basically be very hard to demine an area and make land unusable. So for agriculture and things like that, I think. Do you have anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, it was absolutely a tactic throughout Southeast Asia, throughout all of those wars. And so many hundreds of different types of explosives and weapons were dropped and sprayed, including Agent Orange and a whole host of other agents that were defoliants. And even today, there are parts of Laos where only grass grows because the vegetation has never recovered. And although studies are minimal, I mean, the contamination still shows up in fish and in lands, particularly around bases, where it's highly, highly toxic even now, 50 years later. And the idea was to starve people and to also drive them underground. Literally, people were living in caves, and they could not come out during the day to farm or use the land or anything. So they had to try to find ways to eat that didn't involve cooking fires or farming out in the open.
And during the Vietnam War, the U.S. ceded clouds to try and make it rain, to make it muddy, so the North Vietnamese couldn't bring supplies down on the Ho Chi Minh Trail. So that was trying to use environmental warfare.
Exactly. Okay, everyone's hands are up. Amber.
Hi, my name is Amber. I'm a sophomore at UC Berkeley and a student fellow at The Nation covering climate change. My question is about, like, I guess your experience covering wars that are caused by the fossil fuel industry and oil, and, yeah, as, like, a driver of climate change and environmental harm.
Wars, can you give an example?
Like, for example, I think the Iraq war, I think, is, like, widely... like oil was like a driver of like that conflict in the first place, and just sort of like those histories of like conflicts that are like caused by like oil interests and stuff like that.
Okay. Anyone want to tackle that? I mean, Ukraine, there was natural gas involved, of course, but yeah, I don't know if that's what drove
any,
it.
I don't have any direct experience on this. You know, research. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyone on the panel? Have anything? Basically, the question was if you could talk about wars that were driven by fossil fuel interests.
I think the when we attacked Iraq, the U.S. wanted to get a hold of their oil, so that was part of the idea.
We don't have an expert on. We don't have anyone that covered any of that, but. Thanks. That's a good question, though. Yes, gentleman over here, I'm going to give you the mic.
Sure.
I mean, the Vietnam War was for natural resources, too. We thought there would be a lot of oil there.
Yeah, it's connected to a lot of wars, for sure.
Yeah, I've written a
opinion
on the oil war connection. Mm-hmm. Again, David Helvarg, SCJ member. I'm a war correspondent turned environmental journalist, mm-hmm. and... some of my earlier skill sets are very good when covering hurricanes and wildfires with the Coast Guard or CAL FIRE. In fact, you know, also writing about the need to, we're overly invested in war making, underly invested in disaster response. I have questions and experience about how our media industry is responding to the environmental aspects of war, but I could either go on with my frustrations or just ask some questions I know you can answer. Specifically,
could you answer her question, though? I mean, I don't know if there was...
I could talk to you about them.
Okay, so, yeah.
Carolyn, I guess I'd ask, I'm going to mispronounce the nuclear complex, but I wonder what the ongoing status, since that's the biggest environmental disaster that could happen out of the Ukraine war. And Tariq, I guess I'd ask if there's going to be... When Gaza is no longer being bombed, do you see it having potable water? I mean, these are some of the first environmental issues that I guess would have to be addressed once food is brought in. Will there be sources of water left in Gaza?
The Zaporizhia nuclear power plant is the one you're mentioning. Right now, it's a big fear. It is not a thing happening on the ground, right? So when the Russian troops did, there was also when Russian troops advanced on Chernobyl and they did some trench digging and you know, kicked up some nuclear radiation that was then released. I think that is thought to now be a not a big problem. There is the concern about what happens if Zaporizhia is more drastically directly hit. What happens if some of the cooling water was coming from the Kakhovka Dam that was burst, and so there were concerns about, you know, there not being enough cooling water being allowed to be there. So I don't know the latest status of it, but I do know that the International Atomic Energy Agency has been sending delegates there to keep an eye on things. And so that is definitely a big potential disaster scenario. Right now it is not, you know, creating a current environmental problem.
Okay. Tarek, you want to answer the second question he had?
Can you repeat that? I couldn't hear it very well. It's about the...
Yeah, just actually come over here and talk into him. I mean, I'm sorry, this whole thing.
Yeah, it's hard to measure in the midst of the ongoing bombing and hunger issues, but do you see potable water? I mean, you already said, you know, 75% of the water... drinking water was polluted before this war. What's your projection? What's the major environmental post-war scenario? Is there potable water, or are there other issues that you're concerned about?
Yeah, look, I think first of all, I hope that this will end very, very soon. And currently we are working on mainly on off-grid technologies for the day after, to provide people in Gaza with the portable water that they need, the technologies that they need to treat their wastewater. The Gazans cannot treat wastewater because of the lack of electricity. And this brings us probably to the previous question, the oil, the natural gas that the region here uses to produce the electricity. Gaza needs electricity 24/7 in order to desalinate water, to produce drinking water, and also to treat the wastewater to prevent the pollution of the Eastern Mediterranean and also the aquifer in Gaza. Before the war, the aquifer was polluted, but was polluted, it's not because of the lack of technologies. It was the lack of power, the lack of electricity. Gaza used to receive 3 to 8 hours of electricity a day, and wastewater treatment plants need 24/7 of electricity. So to allow people to have clean aquifer and have portable water, we need to provide them with the electricity to treat the wastewater and to desalinate water, to desalinate the seawater. And probably these are the most important things that we need to do once this war is over. And also another important challenge that Gaza is facing right now and will face probably for the next decade is the debris from the destroyed buildings. We expect that currently there's more than 35 million tons of building debris, and this will also pollute the aquifer. So the technologies that we need right now is off-grid technologies to help people not to rely on the infrastructure. Building the infrastructure will take years. Technologies that treat wastewater off-grid using solar energy. Technologies that desalinate water or generate water from the humidity in the air. And we sent these technologies into Gaza before the war. So in the short term, off-grid technologies. In the long term, we need 24/7 of electricity to help people deal with the environmental challenges that they have.
Thank you. Other questions? Yes, I'll let it over here. I'm going to go to the side of the room.
Thank you. Uh-huh. Hi, I'm Marlo Starling, a freelancer based in New York. So this is more of a question, I think, for Karen and Carolyn. I'm wondering what some of the ways are of journalists being able to follow up on the stories that we're writing about this and continue reporting on these issues without retelling the same story. I don't know if that manifests in just exploring different angles and what those suggestions might be, but also in the same vein, like, how do we convince our editors that we need to be continuing to report on, you know, that same thing because people are continuing to deal with these issues, you know, as we discussed.
So I think in this case, you know, it's an ongoing issue, and so there are always new environmental impacts happening. But also, as I mentioned, there's not a lot of data right now. There wasn't, you know, last summer when I was in Ukraine about the environmental impact and how it was impacting people's health. You know, what we really want to know is how is this impacting, well, a lot of what we want to know is how is it impacting people. So, for example, I shadowed an environmental scientist who's crisscrossed Ukraine collecting soil samples to determine the toxicity of war rubble, you know, when tanks are blown up, what that does to the soil. She didn't have any results when I talked to her in the summer because it took so long to get samples out of the country, two labs tested and get back. So, you know, you could follow up on data, see when there's new data, and then you actually have real, like, hard facts to be reporting. You know, you can revisit the place a year later. There are great time pegs for anniversaries. Follow up on health impacts. So Susan has done great reporting on this, not in conflict, but, you know, so this happened 5 years ago. What are the health impacts? Do we see health impact clusters in any of these impacted areas? You know, is there water testing that's happening after the conflict cools down a little bit to understand a little bit more about what we're seeing there? And I think, you know, I think your editor should be excited that you're returning to these stories and not just wanting to report on them when they're like the sexy, shiny new thing, but following up and keeping those stories on the radar. So just a couple of thoughts I have there. I'm sure you have more to say.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I would also say that looking out for scientific studies that come out, because there is new research coming out all the time. And so, for example, one of the stories that we did several years ago now was on that whole bomb turbation concept, which we did for UNDARC with a written story and a video. But that was based on the fact that the first papers about that concept were coming out. So if you can find something that makes the angle timely, and, you know, there's that sort of news hook. But then the other thing, too, is just, I mean, it involves investing your own time and often, unfortunately, money, but just going back to the place, because every time I've gone back to a place like that, meeting up with sources, again, just opens up so many new doors and so many new stories, because it's like, okay, you need to meet this person, and this person, and see this story over here. And if I hadn't laid out that money on my own to do that, I never would have come across those stories.
And Karen, I actually have a follow-up question for you, because it was a great question, and you mentioned in your talk that it took you a while to get, you know, interest. How did you first, excuse me, come upon this story, and what finally allowed you to do it? Like, how did you finally get the interest?
Well, it was a unique set of circumstances in my case, because the first story I ever wrote about this was in 1998 when I was living in Cambodia and working for a paper there, and I went on vacation to Laos and first saw the issue. But then it was in 2005 when I was doing a story for Archaeology magazine on the Plain of Jars archaeological site and learned that the archaeologists there they couldn't work without a bomb clearance team. And in the time that we were there to report that story, about 2.5 weeks, we heard about more than 24 accidents, mostly involving children, just in the area where we were. So my husband is also an SEJ member. We said we need to do something more on this. And we did a book before the film. But we had that opportunity because we were in the region and could go, you know, back again and again.
Great. Okay. More questions out there. Anna.
Anna Barnes with Great Lakes Echo. So as a student, I have an international and an environmental concentration, so this is kind of like interesting to me. But obviously, we don't have war on our front here in the U.S. So what do you guys do to go about being more sensitive to the topic in a country like we don't have that experience, so we can't exactly relate to the people we're talking to, our sources? How do you remain more sensitive to the people that you talk to in those countries?
Do you want to take a first job?
When you say sensitive, what exactly do you mean?
Just because you know that they don't have, you don't have like the same like experiences and like the hardships that they're having with the environment.
I think the main thing is just taking the time, really, really slowing down. I mean, we as journalists are so often put into this mindset of having to get it done, having to get the story. And again, you know, it's so hard being a journalist, especially if you're, I mean, you have more freedom if you're a freelancer, but then again, you don't always because you don't have the resources. But if you're able to find a way to take that extra time and say, okay, before I even do an interview, I need to just get to know this person. And I need to make them feel comfortable so that we're all sort of seeing each other on the same page. But if you don't do that, you'll never get to the point where you can really, you know, get into those interviews and the information that you are looking for.
I'll add something quick. I would be remiss if I didn't say that all the work that, you know, international reporters do relies heavily on people on the ground, local fixers, translators, local producers. you know, I could not have done this reporting in Ukraine without a fantastic local producer. So you rely on them so much, to cue you into some things maybe you wouldn't notice about being in a different situation wherever you go, whether you're reporting from, you know, a flood zone in Pakistan or a war zone, which is also very, you know, different experience in my life, or a experience, you know, in war. So rely on locals, listen to their perspective, take their steer on certain things that might be matters of cultural competence, I'll say. And then the other thing is, this is your job as a journalist, is report all the time on people who are experiencing things that are very different from you, even if that's just somebody down the road who just, you know, lives in the same community as you, but just had some terrible accident happen to their family or something. You're always needing to put yourself in other people's shoes, and this is the same.
Great. Okay, we'll move to the other end of the room. Okay. First you, and then... Oh, sorry. Woman in the white sweater, and then gentleman in the gray, and then come back. We still have time, so folks.
Hi, my name is Kat Murphy. I am an undergraduate student at Quinnipiac University and an incoming investigative journalism fellow at the University of Maryland. I'm curious how we as reporters should be presenting the severity of the long-term global climate impacts when the short-term political agendas are so forefront right now. I think, like, how do we get people to care about those long-term effects when the polarization is making it so that the current political climate is the only thing that we seem to care about?
Is it a specific, or all of them, any of them? Okay.
I have a follow-up. are you talking about in war, or with, like, you're talking polarization, are you talking climate politics?
Like, how do we get people to care about the long-term effects of these wars when people are mostly concerned about, like, currently, especially with Israel, Gaza, the political climate?
Okay. I think the question I have more is, like, how do you report on these stories when the environmental impact, when people are also dying? Like, I think, obviously, like, my show does so much war coverage on both of these, and so it's not like we're only reporting on the environmental impact, right? And that's part of it. You put the human stories first and give the appropriate weight to these types of stories, and then show how the environmental impact will impact people. In terms of polarization, do you have any thoughts on this right now?
Well, I was going to say that eventually it's all going to be blurred, because climate and climate change and, you know, the planetary crises are driving conflicts. And so there's going to be a point where it's all kind of the same. I mean, you can't really separate conflict from climate change and the other things that our planet is facing at the moment, and trying to get that across to audiences and editors, I think, is key.
Guys, Tarek or Alan, do you have anything to say?
Yeah, I 100% agree that, you know, climate is not only an environmental issue, climate change. It's a first degree security issue too. If we look to the immigration from South America to the U.S., it's driven also by climate. The Arab Spring that started in, you know, Syria, Egypt, part of it was also because of the droughts that happened in the northern parts of Syria, and people had to migrate to Damascus, and that created instability. If we look to the population growth in the Jordan Valley, in the Palestinian side, we don't see any growth. It's stable. That means farmers leave their farming activities and they migrate to city centers, and that creates also pressure and instability. So they are correlated with each other. So solving environmental issues, helping people to cope and adapt to climate change, this creates stability and probably, hopefully, less wars and conflicts around the world.
And I'll just say climate change and nuclear issues were much more important in the past. In the 1980s, there were marches. Millions of people wanted to end the arms race. Now it's not very high on people's agendas because they have much more immediate needs. So it's hard to get people's attention, and they think there hasn't been a nuclear war in almost 80 years. I'm not going to worry about it. But I think we have to solve this problem so we have the luxury of worrying about gradual climate change.
Thanks. Okay, there was a gentleman back here, and then we're going to get... Okay, let me just give you the mic. So,
am I loud enough? No.
Okay, then I need a mic. So I'm also...
Make sure it's on.
You have to hold it real close.
Sorry, it's not the best mic. Okay, can you hear me? Okay, this I'm Glenn Scherer, and I'm from Munga Bay also. And I'm looking for stories on planetary health. And most of you in here can't afford to get to Ukraine or to the Middle East. But I suggest looking at the military-industrial complex and the supply chain, because it goes right back to our communities, and it's poisoning water in our communities. It's poisoning the air in our communities. I mean, look at a place like Hanford where they made the bombs. I mean, just horrific damage. Not on the scale of the wars, and I don't want to take any attention away from the wars themselves, but bombs got to get made to drop on Laos. Weapons have to get made. And the other thing is, biggest polluter in the world is the U.S. military. There's military bases with Superfund sites all over our country, and they're being largely ignored. So there's a lot of stories out there, and you don't have to travel halfway around the world to get them, war stories, even though there may not be a war in your community.
That's a great point. Thank you. Thank you for that. That's a great point for any like local journalists out there who can't get abroad. Was there other question? There was a question over here. No? It was answered. Okay. I'll go over to this side. Sorry. Lots of questions.
All right. Thank you for the opportunity. My name is Abdulkari Majid. I'm a journalist from Nigeria. I report business and environment. My question goes to Caroline. You talked about the country you talk, what is Ukraine? Sorry, that you are trying to carry out record of maybe damages, document, and all of that, so they'll be able to maybe put a cost to it. I know back in Nigeria, particularly in the northeastern part of Nigeria, where we had Boko Haram issues and all of that, and a lot of environmental destruction were also going on there, to the point that maybe the pastoralists who are moving cattle and all of that, there's a shortage of water and they had to move. Mm-hmm. So we have extreme weather events, you know, aggravating and all of that. But my question is, for them to be able to do that and be able to put a cost to it, have they been carrying out, are there existing data of, let's say, the kind of plants that were existing there before now, the kind of maybe... the quality of the biodiversity, animals, and all of that that were existing there, were there taxonomists who have documented this plant in the past? So they'll be able to say, oh, now, after the war, we can find this, we can find that. I just want to use that to see if we could also apply similar thing back home in Nigeria, in the water northeast.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So what the Ukrainian government is doing is sending inspectors from their, I forget which department, but from their one of their government departments to the sites of missile strikes and other impacts to do a survey of the damage done. So they will, you know, assess, okay, how many thousands of gallons of oil were in this depot? How many do we think burned and went up into the atmosphere? And how much do we think seeped into the groundwater and soil? And then they're doing their own accounting to figure out what the dollar value of that is. It is a pretty convoluted assessment that does not follow any international, as far as I can tell, it doesn't follow any sort of published guidance on how to do this or any international standards for measuring this. So some of the criticism is what they could more effectively be doing is looking at the, you know, looking at exactly what is there, measuring, doing testing, and then just kind of saving that raw data so that at some point in the future they could derive a dollar value. What they're doing is they're putting that dollar value out as the product of that inspection that they're doing. And so there's some criticism that because this is not any sort of international standard method, they're doing these like creative multipliers and things that, you know, you know, it's hard to say that that's going to hold up in some sort of international court of law or something. So I don't know to what extent they're looking at, like, specifically local flora and fauna, or more just, okay, this was 5 acres that was burned. We've decided that 5 acres is worth this much money, and we're going to put that dollar figure on it. So I think there are some standards that could be used for folks if they're not already in, you know, in Nigeria. And I'm not sure that, you know, the experts I spoke to, you know, had some feedback on the methods being used in Ukraine while saying they're a country at war. They are doing this in the way that they feel like they can. So, you know, like reserving judgment at this point, I think. But yeah, I think, yeah, hopefully that it helped.
My name is Nana Mohammed. I'm also from Nigeria, but I'm a student here at NYU studying science, health, and environmental reporting. And I've tried to report on the environmental impacts of war in the Northeast, where I came from. And also, how do you deal with the situation where you don't have enough data to kind of show that this is the reality of things, but you could see that the people are suffering from the impacts of climate while they deal with the issue of war? And when you look up for data, you only have data that has to do with the humanitarian crisis, the number of people that have been killed, the number of people that have been displaced. Like, in that situation, how you deal with that? And also to understand which point to kind of bring up in your reporting.
Great question.
Do you want us to take a second?
So, yeah, I mean, that is a huge problem, often not having any data to look at. But there's immense power in the human narrative. And it's also a difficulty often, especially if you're working for scientific publications, but many editors will say, well, where's the study on that? Where's the data? Where's the evidence? If you're able to show through, you know, many, 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 many different people's accounts of what they are experiencing on the ground, telling you, showing you, if you can document, if you can go there and see it, take photos, and just keep on working on that, trying to persuade editors and saying, look, there is no data, and that actually is the story, that this is what everybody's saying is happening, and there's no data. That's a story.
You could also look at where similar things, maybe a similar type of weapon has been used in the past. Is there documentation of what impact that had 20 years ago when there has been time to document that and say, you know, this same type of munition was used in this area, this was the impact. So you could look back historically as another factor. And then I totally agree with what you said, the human story. And then are there local experts? Are there people who maybe haven't published anything but, you know, have some sort of expertise professionally or just their lived experience? The sad fact is data is a lot more available in places with more resources, with more. So it's a disparity that is a problem, that where we have data and where we don't.
Okay, we're here.
Thank you. My name is Rita Yelda, and I'm the media manager for Natural Resources Defense Council. And my question, I'm trying to think how to phrase it. So we talked earlier on, like, how do you report on environmental impacts when people are dying? And my question is kind of similar, but it's more so, like, is there an appetite from editors to talk about some of these irreplaceable habitats and wildlife specifically? So I know right now a lot of the dialogue about what's going on in Gaza and Palestine is about, water shortages and food shortages, impact of war. But is there anybody that is tracking, you know, the irreplaceable wildlife or irreplaceable ecosystems there? And what, like, is that too hyper-focused for an editor to be interested in?
Okay. Well, I guess there's two questions, and maybe one, the first one goes to Tarek. Like, you know, is anyone tracking this? I don't know if Tarek can answer questions about editors, but... do you have any answers for that? Did you hear the question, by the way?
Yes, I did. Okay. Yes, I did. Look, currently, it's no one is able, you know, to travel between the south and north parts of Gaza. So the freedom of movement is zero in Gaza. They don't think that there are people who are collecting data on that. But we work with a lot of non-governmental organizations in Gaza that they used to collect data on these topics before the war, and they have no doubt that they will go back and, you know, measure these impacts on the biodiversity, on the ecosystem, on the plantations, the soil, water samples. And I think we will have that data just a few months after the war is over.
Thanks. And I don't know if either of you, I mean, you kind of answered this question about the editors, but maybe you can, anything to add?
Yeah, I think it's like, when is the right time to be raising specific issues and when is too soon? And yeah, for ecosystems specifically, and then I think, you know, with all environment reporting, and maybe especially in this case, it's like, you know, what is the human impact? Does this, of course there is a value for eco, you know, not disregarding the value that nature has just on its own, but in a wartime situation, it might be a more immediate, you know, you might be able to sell environmental impacts that have impacts on humans and human health a little easier or a little sooner in sort of the trajectory of a narrative.
The only thing I would add is that I think it's often a very Western sort of U.S.-centric concept that the environments and the human factor, you know, they're separate.
Yeah.
But in so many conflict areas, so many places we're talking about, people don't separate themselves from their environment. So if people are dying or if their environment is destroyed, that's destroying the people too. So if you can get that point across.
Yeah, great point.
Yeah.
We are part of nature.
We're kind of coming to the end, but I think we have time for like one more question. Go back here. Which one wants to ask the question?
Okay, sorry. I just wanted to ask for reporters who are not able to go be in the place, are there ways that we can still responsibly cover? Like, I think a lot of us have seen sort of a gap in the coverage in environmental and climate-focused news organizations and want to be covering, and also we don't have the resources or the ability to go be in Gaza or go be in Ukraine. How can we do that well when we're not there to sort of speak with sources ourselves?
Have you ever reported a story that you haven't gone out in the field to report?
Yes, but I think it's different. Especially when we're dealing with really highly politicized things, like how do you sort of like make the connections and sort of vet your sources? The way that does quite frankly feel differently to
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't mean to be I didn't mean to be flippant there. I was just thinking it's the similar strategies. I mean, yeah, I think the politicization issue is you know, a little separate, but like it's a matter of really vetting and understanding the perspectives of the people that you're speaking with and what their skin in the game is and what perspective they are representing in your story. Right. So I think, and then other than that, I mean, I think it's the similar strategies that you deploy when you're reporting remotely about anything. I think being aware of who's talking from what perspective and vetting them maybe is the additional layer that you want to put on there. Also knowing that things change really quickly, and a lot of situations are very fluid. You know, I haven't been reporting on this topic in Gaza, so that's not something I can directly speak to, but
I do think, I mean, I'll just jump in here because I've done a lot of reporting over the years from the immigrant communities in Philadelphia, and things happen, right? So, for instance, in Ukraine, you go and talk to the folks who may have just immigrated here from the war zone or people who have family members there. And similar with Gaza or anything else, I mean, I've done lots of stories like that where it's sort of a local angle on a war that's happening somewhere else. But really local listeners and local readers connect to it because they're like, oh, those are my neighbors. And they have family and those family, you know, and they can give you their experience either having just been there or having family members in those war zones. So guys, I think that wraps it up. We're like at the end. Rick had, I had to leave. I'm sorry. But round of applause for Alan, who zoomed in from New Jersey. And Carolyn and Karen did a great job. Yep. Thank you.